Would you please turn with me in your Bibles to the Song of Solomon? The Song of Solomon. The Song of Songs. Because amid all of the marriage guides and marriage manuals about making love, there is this one short book in the Bible that is most deserving of our full attention. And we have already wonderfully had our attention drawn to this book this morning as Ben Patterson just preached an outstanding message. And I sat there in the second row just enjoying and benefiting, as well as reorganizing and rearranging my message for this afternoon. So we were well served by Ben. That was an outstanding message. But he also created work for me, and I hope the work he created ends up serving you. And it's a joy to preach after him. It's an honor to preach after him. And I am the beneficiary of all he communicated this morning and the preparation of your hearts for what we are going to consider this afternoon as we give full attention to this most deserving of books, the Song of Songs. King Solomon was famous for his skill as a composer of songs. In 1 Kings chapter 4, we read that he spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005. And of those 1,005, this would be the most beautiful of the songs that are attributed to Solomon. It is the Song of Songs, clearly indicating its superlative quality. When this was released, it immediately went to number one on the charts in Jerusalem, and it eventually went platinum, and it is preserved for us in Holy Scripture this morning as quite the gift from God. This book is the uninhibited, unashamed celebration of romance and passion and sexuality in the context of marriage. This book is uninhibited, this book is unashamed, and therefore I think it's appropriate that I be uninhibited and that I be unashamed this morning in my proclamation from the content of this particular book. Normally, I live somewhat uninhibited, but this afternoon I've got divine permission to be uninhibited and unrestrained from the Song of Songs. But before we look in some detail, before I introduce or draw your attention to certain texts and themes, we must take a few moments to discuss the appropriate interpretation of this unique book. Because from my experience, it has become popular or quite common today to have this book interpreted symbolically, spiritually, interpreted as allegory, as if Solomon primarily had in mind, as this was penned, the relationship between Christ and the church. Personally, I don't think Solomon had the relationship between Christ and the church primarily in mind. Now, please don't misunderstand. Without doubt, marriage points to a greater reality. Marriage points to the greater reality of the relationship between Christ and the church. But I think that the primary emphasis of this particular song is the celebration of the gift of romance and sex in the context of marriage between a man and a woman. And therefore, I am going to argue for a different interpretation than is common or popular today. Now, in arguing for this, or taking a few minutes at the outset to argue for this, I trust no one here who has adopted that common and popular interpretation would in any way feel criticized, ridiculed, or offended. That is not my desire. And I understand, I'm walking very carefully here because I'm in disagreement with many of the greats of church history in relation to my understanding and interpretation of this particular book, and I'm in particular disagreement with my historical hero, Charles Spurgeon. And I do not disagree with Spurgeon or any of the greats in church history quickly, easily, or lightly. But I do find myself in a different place from these men in relation to this book. I do not assume that the spiritual interpretation of this book is the intended interpretation or the superior interpretation. And here are just a few reasons why, hoping to persuade you or at least inform you of my position prior to drawing your attention to differing texts and themes in this letter. Here's why. To my knowledge, no New Testament writer quotes or interprets the Song of Solomon as an illustration of spiritual realities. To my knowledge, in my study, no New Testament writer quotes or interprets the Song of Solomon as an illustration of spiritual realities. So I have chosen to conform to the New Testament writers, as I understand it, the New Testament writers and their interpretation and understanding. Second, the book is erotic in nature by divine design, and at no time is my relationship with Christ ever to be referred to erotically. The Bible never adopts sexually explicit language or imagery to describe the relationship between Christ and the church. And such language is really inappropriate as a description of the love of God and the love of God for his people. So I'm not doubting the sincere intention of anyone, but however sincere one's intention, sexual language, in my opinion, should not be included, let's say, in the content of the worship songs we sing or in the communication we have with God in communion. So there's no question that the relationship between husband and wife is ultimately a reflection of Christ and the church, but this does not include our sexuality. Church is referred to as the bride of Christ, but the scripture never indulges in sexually explicit imagery to describe this relationship. So yes, when I'm worshiping this morning, it is appropriate for me to use a vocabulary of love when I am describing my relationship with God or I'm communicating my passion for God, but this should not include language that is erotic in nature. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Second reason. Third reason, and again, this is not an exhaustive list. I think that the spiritual interpretation or the symbolic interpretation is just fraught with interpretive difficulties. And at times, I think in some ways, these can prove to be not only difficult, but even entertaining. Here, that wasn't a very flattering pose. There we go. Here would be just a sampling from my reading. Again, I am not criticizing anyone's motive or intention. I have no question that everybody, any commentary I've read that has adopted any of the following interpretations is sincere and well-meaning. In chapter 1, this is just a sampling. In verse 13, my beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. Well, you can read in certain commentaries that this is a description or declaration of Christ's love for his church, or Christ actually or ultimately appearing between the Old and New Testament scriptures. Now, I'm no scholar, but I don't think so. In chapter 4, verse 11, where we read that your lips drink or drip nectar, there are those who would argue that this reveals that her two lips, in effect, are the law and the gospel. And that in verse 12, a garden locked is my sister, my bride, a spring locked, a fountain sealed, where the mountain of myrrh is referred to, that is a reference ultimately to the hill of Calvary. Chapter 7, verse 7, this is just a sampling. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I have read where this is a reference ultimately to the nurturing doctrine of the church. And I have to say that just even a casual reading, that never would have occurred to me, that when I read your stature is like a palm tree and your breasts are like its clusters, I don't think of nurturing doctrine. I think of breasts. So, without ridiculing anyone, I would argue against a common, popular, allegorical interpretation. More important, here's the interpretation that I would argue for. I think this is a unique book. I think this is a unique book. I think this is a neglected book. I think this is a unique, often neglected book, and often misunderstood book. I think the Song of Songs has a unique place among all the books of the Bible because it is an entire book. An entire book. Not a few verses. Not a chapter or two. An entire book devoted primarily to the celebration of romance and sexuality in the context of marriage. An entire book of the Bible is devoted to this celebration. What a gift from God. What a loud statement by God of these gifts to us. So, I don't think that the relationship between Christ and the church is immediately in view in the Song of Songs, but I do believe that the relationship between husbands and wives is in view. I do believe that the relationship between you and your wife is in view in this unique song. Lloyd Carr, in his fine commentary on the Song of Songs, writes the following: "The lover and the beloved are just ordinary people." I love that. They are just ordinary people. In other words, the Song of Songs is not allegory. It's not typology. It's not a historical record. It's not describing Solomon's experience. No. The lover and the beloved are just ordinary people. Tom Gledhill, in his fine commentary on the Song of Songs, writes the following: "The two lovers," I love this, "the two lovers are every man and every woman. The two lovers are every man and every woman and have nothing to do with Solomon." And listen to this: "In listening to the song, we find that it is speaking not only to us, but about us." So as we overhear this song, it is speaking not only to us, because it's about every man and every woman, but it is speaking about us. And he continues, "A song creates an atmosphere in which we are invited to participate." This will preach. This song creates an atmosphere in which we are invited to participate. You're going to experience an invitation. Even a casual reading of the Song of Songs, a casual reading of the Song of Songs leads to an experience of an invitation. You're being invited to participate. This book was intended by God to create and cultivate holy arousal between a husband and a wife. It's a song where we are invited to participate. Now, I anticipate a high percentage of application by you men after this seminar. And actually, I'm a little concerned because my very good friend Mark Dever is going to preach what I know is going to be an excellent message in the next session. But I'm a little concerned because after you hear from the Song of Songs, I'm not sure you'll be concerned about what the Puritans think about sex. I'm not sure that'll be a high priority item for you an hour and a half from now. And you might feel a moral obligation to apply this book of the Bible to your life and to your marriage. And then I'm serving you big time, guys, because what my wife is doing with your wives right now is worth whatever time you're investing here in this session this afternoon. You're welcome. You're welcome. Now, I'm not encouraging you to excuse your attendance this afternoon, but I do think this session could have been better positioned. I mean, this should be like an evening session. We can all run back to our rooms afterward. and celebrate what we've read here and apply it to our lives and experience the grace of God and the transforming effect of the Song of Songs. Let's head on down to the seminar where our wives are right now. Now, that wouldn't be wise. That would be premature. You will benefit from what they are hearing from my wonderful wife. The two lovers. Isn't this encouraging? They're every man and every woman. And if we listen carefully to this song, it's speaking. It's speaking not only to us, but it's speaking about us. And it's creating an atmosphere in which we are invited to participate. Now, one of my hopes in having this privilege, I would hope to create a desire in your heart. I believe Ben already created this desire, so I'm adding my voice to the desire I believe he has already created. I would hope that a desire would be created in your heart to immerse yourself personally in this book. And that long after this conference is over, you are devoting necessary time to the study of the Song of Songs. That really for the rest of your life, you will be receiving this invitation to participate in these gifts that have been provided by God for the good of your marriage, ultimately for His glory. So that's been my prayer in private. Lord, may there be an immediate effect by your grace from this session as a result of proclaiming your word accompanied by the gift of illumination. But Lord, may there not only be an immediate effect, may there be an enduring effect. Create in the hearts of the men in attendance a desire to immerse themselves in this book and to study this book for themselves and to encounter you in and through this unique book. So I pray that desire has been created. I pray that you won't be satisfied until you have an extended period of time studying this book. I mean, what a sweet recommendation. Make this a primary object of content for your practice of the spiritual disciplines for the next 6 months. Now, if you do that, and I hope you do, you're going to need help. You're going to need help because this is a difficult book to understand. I mean, as I studied numerous commentaries, the scholars all seem to be in agreement that the two most difficult books in the Bible to interpret are the book of Revelation, no surprise there, but secondly, the Song of Songs. One author speaks of the Song of Songs as a kind of charmed confusion. See, there isn't a tidy chronological order to the Song of Songs. There isn't an easily discernible order to the Song of Songs. So you're going to need a scholar to hold your hand if you're going to understand this book. Because if you try to study and understand this book, I think apart from the help of godly scholarship, I think you're going to be confused rather than aroused. But with the help of godly scholars, you will experience the gifts God intends from this unique and wonderful book. So, books are available in the bookstore, and two in particular that I want to recommend. Let these scholars hold your hand. The Message of the Song of Songs from the Bible Speaks Today series by Tom Gledhill. This is probably my personal favorite, and it's available. And Lloyd Carr's commentary on the Song of Songs is also available. I've already quoted both of these men, and I am indebted to these men. I have benefited significantly, immeasurably, from these men and their scholarship and their writing. And so I commend these commentaries to you to assist you as you immerse yourself personally in this particular song. The Song of Songs. This song is about us. This song is about us and is intended by God to speak to us and make a difference for the glory of God in our marriages. Now, there's two themes I want to draw to your attention time permitting. Two themes I want to draw to your attention. Because of the excellent job Ben did this morning, I took the period over lunch just to adjust. I mean, I know every speaker is facing this challenge, so this comment should elicit no sympathy from you. But one of the really challenges of preaching, one of the joys of preaching, is that you have so much material and so little time. So what I'm trying to do is really take about 6 hours of material and condense it into one easily understandable hour. And I hope, by God's grace, I'm able to serve you effectively at some point with, as John prayed earlier, just a single sentence that would make a difference in your life, carried into your heart by the Spirit, accompanied by the gift of illumination. So, two themes that I want to draw your attention to in particular, time permitting. One would be romance, and the second would be the gift of sex. First, romance, and the second, the gift of sex. We begin with romance. Throughout this song, there is the presence of pure and passionate romance. And it's evident that romance within marriage is meant to be, by God, meant to be a growing reality and not a distant memory. And gentlemen, husbands, it is our privilege. It is our joy. And it is, I believe, our responsibility to romance our wives. Romance is not optional. Romance is essential. It is an essential preliminary to sexual union, and it ensures that there is greater satisfaction in sexual union. And so we're going to begin appropriately with romance, with the environment necessary for there to be great and God-glorifying sex. Now, if you don't remember anything else I say, please remember this. Before you touch her body, touch her heart and mind. Before you touch her body, touch her heart and mind. Touch her heart and mind before you touch her body. We're going to talk about how to do that. How can I touch my wife's heart and mind? Well, it begins with a unique form of communication. Romance in this song involves a unique form of communication. Communication of a particularly unique nature. Please understand, what we're studying today in relation to marriage is obviously not the totality of what the Bible teaches on marriage, and obviously not the totality of what the Bible teaches on communication. Now, what I'm talking about from this song is a specific kind of communication, a specialized form of communication that is erotic in nature and meant to provoke godly and God-glorifying arousal. So what we want to pay attention to is really, throughout this song, how these two lovers are speaking to and of each other. Dwayne Garrett, in his commentary on the Song of Songs, writes the following. He says of these two lovers that they relish their pleasure in each other, listen, not only with physical action, but with, this is worth memorizing, carefully composed words. They relish their pleasure in each other, not only with physical action, but with carefully composed words. Love is, above all, a matter of the mind and heart and should be declared. The lesson he writes for the reader is that he or she needs to speak, listen, often and openly of his or her joy in the beloved, the spouse. And then this final statement, so simple, so profound, so full of life-transforming potential. Many homes would be happier if men and women would simply speak of their love for one another a little more often. They would. My home, your home, would be happier if we would simply speak of our love for one another a little more often. But not speak in generalities. Speak with carefully composed words. See, both the feeling of passion and the articulating of this passion are really modeled for us in the Song of Songs. This is, you are reading carefully composed words. Carefully composed words are before you that are romantic and erotic in both nature and content and effect as well. Now, let's just look at a few of these expressions, but actually prior to even turning to an initial passage, I need to inform you, because this can be confusing. You look in any detail at any of these interchanges, and you are encountering Eastern poetry, which at least for some of us, if not many of us, is foreign to us. So the language employed here, it's strange. It's foreign. This is Near Eastern poetry. This is not drama. This is not history. And the metaphors that are being used throughout this song to describe the various parts of the body, they initially will seem strange to some, if not many of us, and maybe even humorous. So I'm not recommending you romance your wife with quotations from the Song of Songs. I mean, commit to memory the Song of Songs, but don't seek to romance your wife with the content directly from the Song of Songs unless she has her own understanding and appreciation of the Song of Songs. So Ben gave us an illustration this morning. You don't want to say to your wife from chapter 7, your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. You don't want to make a statement like that to your wife, because that's not going to arouse your wife, at least in an erotic way. See, he's not saying to her, your nose, it's huge, okay? You have an unusually large nose. That's not in any way what he's saying. When he speaks of her nose like the Tower of Lebanon, he is complimenting her about the difference her nose makes on her face. And it's like looking out on a nondescript horizon and seeing a tower that transforms the effect of your view of that horizon. And he is saying to her, your nose has that effect on your face and in my heart as I observe you. That is what he is communicating. So obviously some explanation, some interpretation is necessary here. Now, your background might be different from mine. I didn't grow up reading poetry. I wish I did. Actually, if you acknowledge in the neighborhood I grew up in that you read poetry, well, you would be the object of physical violence. So I don't know anybody on Hodges Lane in Tacoma Park, Maryland, who read poetry. And if they did, they never revealed it, and for good reason. So my background is not a poetic background. All right? I didn't grow up appreciating, devoting myself to formal education. I wasn't drawn to Shakespeare, didn't appreciate Shakespeare, didn't care for Shakespeare. That's to my shame. But that's a hindrance when you come to a book like this, which is all about poetry, and you have no taste for poetry, you have no appreciation of poetry, you have no background in poetry, and therefore it can be a drawback for someone like myself without formal education and appreciation and understanding of poetry. Well, I am growing. I understand that the author of this song was very masculine, so there's nothing effeminate about poetry, and I'm growing gradually, nothing impressive, in my understanding and appreciating of both the content, the nature and the content and the effect of poetry, particularly on my wife. You see, there's a beauty, there's a brilliance contained in this song. The most private emotions about the most intimate parts of a spouse's body can be expressed romantically and erotically and tastefully and descriptively. And that's found in and throughout this song. There's the complete absence in this song of medical language, crudeness, the absence of all vulgarity. So let's just look at a single interchange and begin with the assumption that they are attracted to each other and that the metaphors being employed are an expression really of the beauty that they observe in each other. Turn to chapter 4, if you would please. Chapter 4. Here is how he touches her heart and mind before he touches her body. This is romantic, erotic communication. Behold carefully composed words. Behold inspired, divinely inspired, carefully composed words. Behold, verse 1, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that gaze among the lilies. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. No flaw in you. Whoa. Beautiful. Romantic. Erotic. This is how he feels about her. And he has composed words carefully to communicate specifically and erotically how he feels about her. And notice the detail. He begins in verse 1. Really, he begins and ends this section with these categorical declarations of her beauty, which for him are no exaggeration. And then he proceeds after the categorical declaration of her beauty in verse 1, notice how specific. Your eyes are doves. So that would communicate there's gentleness. When I look into your eyes, I see tenderness. Your hair. He likens her hair in one see to a flock of goats that are leaping down the slopes of Gilead. It's really about the flowing movement, if you will, of a flock as they proceed down a grassy slope. And as I understand it from my reading, most Palestinian goats have long, wavy black hair. So he's really describing the movement of a large flock of goats on a distant hill that just makes it appear as if the whole hillside is alive. And that's how he describes her hair. And remember, her hair is her glory. He proceeds to teeth in verse 2. Her teeth are, they're white. They are white like a flock of shorn ewes. And they are gleaming. And they are symmetrically matched. The good news is there's not one of them missing. She's not missing any of her teeth. Prior to modern dentistry, this was most likely a big deal. In verse 3, your lips. And the word used in the Hebrew here is for mouth. It's one that describes an organ of speech, meaning that her speech is beautiful. Her speech is consistent with her beauty. It's possible to be beautiful and have an unlovely mouth. So this commendation is a moral one as well. Her mouth reveals her heart, and her speech is consistent with her beauty. He just continues. 3b, your cheeks are like the halves of a pomegranate. There's a blush red smoothness about her cheeks. Her neck is like the Tower of David. Again, that doesn't mean he's not saying to her, you have an unusually long neck. No, it's not the size of her neck. It's really a picture of her dignity. She is dignified. She is dignified. And then her breasts in verse 5, they are graceful, they are soft, they are part of her God-given sexual appeal. And then in verse 7, in his eyes, she's perfect. Now, is that not the effect of romance? Is that not the legitimate effect of romance? Is that not the legitimate effect of godly passion? It can legitimately exaggerate the plain and ordinary and legitimately overlook defects. He is amazed. This woman is beautiful in his eyes, perfect in his eyes. He's not describing so much how much she looks. He's not describing her looks, but how she feels about her and her looks. In other words, he's not giving information for somebody to pick her up from the airport. That's not what this is about. This is how he feels when he looks at her. Looking at her provokes these carefully composed responses from him. And through these carefully composed words, he touches her heart and mind. Now listen, a wise man understands the value and effect of carefully composed words in preparation for sexual union. A wise man understands their value. This was a wise man. He understood their value. So, let's take a moment on application. How often in the last month has communication of this nature taken place between you as husband and wife? And please understand, as I walk through this application, I apply this first and foremost to my life, and I hope you sense that. I'm not here as some self-righteous expert scolding you men. I'm here as a fellow sinner saved by grace. I'm here as a fellow learner. And as I work my way through this material, my application begins with me. And I hope you sense that in tone and content this afternoon. So, how often in the last month has communication of this nature taken place between you as a husband and wife? Do you understand that when you say to your wife, "You look nice," that isn't uniquely erotic? That when you say to your wife, "That's a nice dress," I wouldn't say those were carefully composed words. I'd say they reveal more a lazy husband, a selfish husband. So how often in the last month has communication of this nature taken place? Number two, what are the hindrances? If it hasn't, what are the hindrances? What are the hindrances for you to create carefully composed words that are so specific and erotic in nature for and to your wife? What are the hindrances? What are the heart issues to giving verbal expression of this nature? We all need to, in light of the cross, examine our hearts. Always do that in the shadow of the cross, but let us examine our hearts to discover where remaining sin would seek to be warring against the cultivation of romance in our marriages. What are the hindrances in your soul to verbal expression of this nature? And then number three, what changes can you make? What changes can you make beginning today? What changes can you make beginning today, this week in particular, to cultivate and express your passion for your spouse? Now, I'm not asking you to be Solomon or Shakespeare. That's not the standard. And there is a wide spectrum of creativity possible. As I've had the privilege to present this material in various churches where I've had the privilege to serve, I've been pleasantly surprised at the creativity of the men present. And so here are a couple of sampling of what they have created, which I think reveals just different preferences and different cultures, because I don't want you restricted by this or trying a strict emulation of this. So one individual came to me after a session where we taught material similar to this, and He's from the West, and this is what he created for his wife. You are like freshly shucked corn in a trough filled with a herd of hungry hogs. And he was quite happy with that. And I said to him, he's from Texas, I just said, listen, if that is the appropriate expression of your love for your wife, then Solomon would be proud of you. So this isn't to be restrictive. Another individual came from the South and gave me this. Collard is green, my dog's name is Blue, and I'm so lucky to have a sweet thing like you. Your hair is like corn silk, a flapping in the breeze, softer than blues and without all them fleas. You move like a bass, which excite me in May. You ain't got no scales, but I love you anyway. You're as satisfying as okra, just a frying in the pan. You're as fragrant as snuff right out of the can. You have some of your teeth, for which I am proud. I hold my head high when we're in a crowd. On special occasions, when you shave under your arms, well, I'm in hog heaven and awed by your charms. And it just goes on and on and on. Now again, I don't find that particularly stimulating or motivating. My wife wouldn't. But if his wife would, and let me tell you something about our wives. Even if his wife didn't find the content stimulating, she would appreciate the effort. She would appreciate the effort. Before you touch your body, touch your heart and mind. How do you touch your heart and mind? Touch your heart and mind with carefully composed words that are specific expressions of how you feel about her, that are erotic in nature, that arouse and provoke romance. Now, I don't want to limit you to carefully composed words. They are obviously a priority, but let's broaden it. Let's not just limit it to words. Let's talk about practices as well, because I think we should consistently be expressing how we feel about our wives and the romantic nature of how we feel about our wives in a variety of ways. So let me give you a few suggestions that I hope you find helpful, a few recommendations. But actually, prior to that, let me qualify that by saying this. Any of these practices, which have characterized my life in differing degrees for the past 30 years that I have had the privilege to be married to Carolyn, any of these practices are related to my study of my wife. See, I'm reluctant to give practices because I'm not appealing for your strict emulation of my practices. I want to provoke you, and certainly if any of these practices are stimulating to you, you may transfer them, but they must proceed from your own study of your wife. You must study your wife. You must know the preferences of your wife. And the study of your wife is, well, it's a lifelong study. It is a lifelong study. And to my shame, I can say, particularly in the early years of my marriage, there was a selfishness that characterized my relating to Carolyn. I wasn't studying her. I was basically asking her to accommodate herself to me. And I was trying to draw her into the world of my preferences. And at times, they were selfish preferences. And that selfish tendency, sadly, continues to this day. I am still studying her. My wife is the most unselfish individual I have ever met. For more than 30 years, I have been the object of her unselfish affection. It is the inclination of her heart to serve me. Sadly, and to my shame, too often, it is the inclination of my heart to be selfish in relation to her. So I have had to put to death selfishness and weaken it in my life and work at studying her. And she's not particularly revealing about her preferences because the inclination of her heart is to serve me. So it's hard work, but oh, sweet fruit. So when I think of so many of our experiences early in our marriage where I'm asking her to accommodate me, so much change has taken place simply because I'm paying much closer attention to her. I have to study her. I listen carefully when she talks. Because at times in a conversation, at times when she's talking with someone else, she'll reveal a preference, and I need to know that preference. I've interviewed my three daughters countless times, asking them to inform me of preferences and desires. that they might be aware of in their mother, that their mother has not revealed to me. I study her. Right up until this, I can just tell you, really within the last month, there have been multiple preferences revealed that I'm now working on creating surprises as a means of communicating, I'm listening and I care. My wife likes mystery. And so she likes books that are revealing, let's say, of the CIA and the FBI. Now, it took me a few years to realize that she enjoys, at times, reading books on these topics. Well, we have this spy museum in downtown Washington, D.C. I discovered it recently, and she doesn't know this, but I'm arranging a full day outing to just say to her, surprise. Now, that's not my preference. It's not a world I'm that interested in. We have people who work for the government in our church, and they can't tell me anything, and I find that frustrating. So I'd just rather not even know they're there. I ask them. I want to get the inside scoop. I'm your pastor. And they tell me that it's, you know, they know nothing other than what's written in the post. So it's just frustrating to me knowing they're sitting out there, they know all kinds of stuff, and they won't tell me. So I'd just rather not know anything about their world. Well, that's what Carolyn did. Carolyn loves downtown Washington, D.C. I don't. That's what she loves. I mean, I could just tell you of different other illustrations where I realized that's what she loves. Now, let me touch her heart and mind. Let me create a surprise. Let me make a statement to her. Before I touch her body, let me do this. Experience the intended effect upon her life. Study your wife. So some of these illustrations might not be applicable to you because your wife might be different. You should know your wife's preferences and location and travel, and vacation and restaurant. You should know those things. Are you a student of your wife? Or has covenant, in effect, been your excuse for laziness and selfishness? Are you a student of your wife? If you haven't been, if you've been a neglectful student, begin immediately becoming a student of your wife. And here are just some practical recommendations for the cultivation of romance. Mark mentioned last night date night. We have been, by God's grace, having date night for us once a week for the past 30 years, and it has just been of immeasurable benefit to us. It's like a vacation every week for us. And it's on Wednesday evenings now. It's been on different evenings over the years. But Carolyn looks forward to it, and we both benefit from it because it exists in every week. So there's this wonderful rhythm. And she knows that minimally for that evening, each week, she is going to have my undivided and unhurried attention. So this past Wednesday night, we went to a place called Bethesda. And it was a beautiful night. And so we ate at an Indian restaurant outdoor and then strolled across the street to a place that served ice cream and sat outside and spent, some 4 hours, not just relaxing together, but relating to each other. And she knows that next Wednesday, it's going to happen again, except it's going to be different. And gentlemen, I think we have the privilege and responsibility to not only create these date nights, to not only help our wives, if we have smaller children, to find someone to care for the children so that these can take place, but also to plan these. So that when I arrive home next Wednesday, I'm not going to be saying to Carolyn, so, are you hungry? What are you hungry for? Where would you like to go? That doesn't make a statement to her of my care. So what I have to do, what I have the privilege to do, is I have to work. I have to work. And so in this IPAC PDA is just a ton of information. The fruit of reading thoroughly sections of the Washington Post, reading monthly the Washingtonian magazine, listening as I overhear conversations with other people about places they've been in our area. And so there's just a whole section on date nights, and I've got all kinds of geographical areas that are within 1 hour of where I live. And I just store this information in it so that I can plan and seek to surprise this woman who is so worthy of surprising because of the sacrifices she makes to serve me on a daily basis. And so every week, and these don't have to be expensive, not at all. It's about the investment of time. A date night, I highly recommend a consistent date night. Phone calls during the day. Normally, there's not a day that goes by where I don't just call Carolyn, not because I have anything in particular I need to talk to her about. I will just say this simply. I just wanted to hear your voice. That's it. Now, it usually leads to other topics. Sometimes it doesn't. But it's just a way to say to her, you are my passion. You are my priority. Regardless of what's happening in this ministry, in this church, and in this world, you have my singular devotion. And I just wanted you to know, at 10:45, I love you. I can't wait to see you later on. And I just wanted to hear the sound of your unique voice answering the phone. Emails. Listen, what a wonderful way to communicate. Emails or letters. I love to study the Civil War, and I am affected by the letters that were written. Oh, I'm affected by the imagination and the vocabulary of men who were supposedly uneducated. And I'm affected when I read a letter that was, in effect, arrived at a wife's home after she discovered that her husband had been killed during action in the Civil War. I want to create notes to my wife that she can enjoy while I am still alive. I read the following note and was provoked. When the new car was sideswiped on a trip to the supermarket, Mary Branson stopped and tearfully fumbled in the glove compartment for the insurance papers. Attached to them, she found an envelope with her name on it in her husband's handwriting, and it said this, "Dear Mary," the note said, "when you need these papers, remember, it's you I love, not the car." Brilliant. I want to emulate the example of this man with those carefully composed words. Gifts. Gifts. Again, this is where you got to study your wife. And I'm not talking about extravagant, expensive gifts. Over the past number of months, my wife has gotten into a candy called Chewy Spree. And I was surprised initially as I went home one day, stopped at a store, assuming Chewy Spree was everywhere, to discover, no, Chewy Spree is not everywhere. Hard Spree is everywhere. Original Spree is everywhere, but not Chewy Spree. So I've had to find a store that has Chewy Spree, because every week, at least once a week, I just love to walk through the door with Chewy Spree. And it just makes a statement to my wife. It has an exaggerated effect on her. Perfume, flowers. By the way, guys, flowers, I don't understand it. They just work. They work, and they always work, and I don't get it. But they work. They are a means of communicating. Clothing. So much is about effort. I mean, I've bought my wife clothes over the years. I know her sizes, and I've found out the stores that she likes to shop in because, like you, I hate not only the Yankees, but the mall. So I'm not going into any mall and just wandering around. What a grand waste of time. Now, when I go to a mall, I'm on a mission. If I'm in a mall, I'm on a mission. I got a purpose, and I got stores. And boy, you talk about feeling uncomfortable. Walking around women's clothing stores, I don't belong. And so I'm trying to pick things out, and the receipt, and normally it moved. She's moved knowing I put forth the effort. She is moved by that. So I've bought her clothes numerous times over the year. I bought her, careful about this, lingerie. You don't want all the clothing you bought her primarily just to be lingerie. And you obviously got to watch where you shop because there's so many pornographic posters. But it you have to know where to go. Where there isn't pornography, it makes a statement. It makes a statement. Now, it's uncomfortable. There's no question that it is uncomfortable. I'm at my most uncomfortable in the lingerie department. People come up, can I help you? No, where's Mrs. Fields' chocolate chip cookie place? I just. Yeah, really, the only thing that makes me more uncomfortable is buying condoms. That's the only thing that makes me more uncomfortable, if you ever had to do that.
Got a price check on the Trojans. Price check on the Trojans.
That'd be paper or plastic. Just give them to me, all right? Just give them to me right now. You just keep the change. romantic overnights. Oh. Do you have them planned out? Unhurried, extended time. We do multiple romantic overnights, usually of a three-day nature, every year. And there's not only the immediate effect, there's a cumulative effect when you've done it for 30 years. Countless memories that last a lifetime. It can be playful stuff, too. It took me years to realize my wife grew up with her mom fishing. She likes fishing. I didn't grow up fishing. Grew up playing all manner of sports. We didn't fish. Wasn't even an option. Fished once. Horrible experience. That's all when I married. One time fishing. Fishing wasn't a category. Wasn't an option. And I realized I'm selfish. She likes to fish. So we've been fishing. It's been a joy. It's been romantic. She loves to ride bikes. Again, I grew out of that. There was nothing competitive about it, so I had to find other ways to express myself. Study your wife. Listen, this involves work. Here's a myth. Two myths. Romance is effortless. Romance is spontaneous. Those are myths. Romance isn't effortless. Romance is hard work. Romance normally isn't spontaneous. And if it is spontaneous, it's usually the fruit of some previous planning. Here's what I do. Again, I'm not appealing for strict emulation, but you need to create and custom design your own practice. Here's what I do. You can be assured that on Monday morning, I usually do this Sunday afternoon since I'll be traveling back tomorrow, I will be doing this on Monday morning. You can assume that every week, Sunday afternoon, Monday morning, I'm at a local Starbucks, and I take, in that period of time, usually a half hour to an hour to plan my week. Part of that planning is how I can romance my wife that week, because that's important. That's a priority. And if I didn't have that time, unhurried time to think, to plan, having studied her, having accumulated numerous ideas as a result of that study and the effort involved in reading and researching what's available for us to do. If I didn't have that time to plan, and then if I didn't transfer and create a plan and then transfer it to my schedule, then all I'm talking about wouldn't have come to pass. So create, custom design your own way to, in effect, interrupt your week. Free yourself from the urgent and devote time to planning ways that you can romance your wife so that this song becomes your song. And do it week after week after week. Touch her heart and mind before you touch her body. Now, in the few moments we have left, let's talk about touching her body. Let's talk about the gift of sex within the covenant of marriage. When are we done? We might already be done. How much more time do I have left? 5 minutes. Great. That's plenty. Okay, let's just regroup here. Listen, let's just look briefly at this celebration and description of the physical relationship and all that's involved in it. Let's just begin with kissing. Just one passage, 4:11, you're right there. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. French kissing did not originate with the French. It's right here in the Song of Songs. I could give you a number. Well, look at chapter 5 since we're right there. Verse 16. His mouth is most sweet and he is altogether desirable. This guy can kiss. He says of her, your mouth is like the best wine. These two are very familiar with each other's mouths. Very familiar with each other's lips. Very familiar with each other's mouths. They are kissing. Their kissing is consistent, their kissing is erotic, their kissing is, it appears to be prolonged, and their kissing certainly is enjoyed. Ask your wife this, what is her estimation of your kissing? How would she evaluate your kissing? And ask her this, how does it compare with what is described here in this Song of Songs? So this is what I've noticed. For many couples, kissing, in really practice and effect, resembles now a little more, as the years go by, it resembles a handshake, a little more than a handshake. Well, that's not what's going on here in these Song of Songs. And kissing is a unique gift from God. Unique gift from God for a husband and wife, a unique expression of their passion, and a unique means of cultivating their passion for each other. But it is easily neglected, and it easily simply becomes routine. So, for application, the following. How often do you kiss? How often do you kiss? Second, how long do you kiss? Third, how passionate is your kissing? Do you need to be reintroduced to this gift of kissing? And if it's not passionate, why isn't it? Don't be satisfied until you discover why. Kissing, touching. They are, throughout this song, touching each other. Time doesn't permit you to draw attention to the various verses, but they are touching each other. How often are you touching your wife? In appropriate ways in public, and obviously in appropriate ways in private. How often? Here's what I attempt to do with Carolyn. If Carolyn is near me, I am touching her. I am either holding her hand or my hand is on her shoulder. If she is near me, I want to touch her. I want to communicate my passion for her through touch. Touching. Listen, you study this book, you won't be able to keep your hands off your wife. And finally, making love. In 4:16, and let's just read this, and I'll give you a few points of application in the final 3 minutes. 4:16, awake, O north wind. Here's really the consummation. And come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. And then he responds, I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. And then here's the response. Eat, friends. Drink. Oh, here's the divine perspective. Here's divine approval. Here's divine encouragement. Eat, friends. Drink. And be drunk with love. Oh, how wonderful. The chorus really calls on them to really enjoy to the fullest extent their love and to be intoxicated together with their love. This is godly. This is godly. This is a form of worship to God. This is God glorifying sex. And if we had time, I could show you passages where the woman takes initiative. And by the way, ladies, if any of you are ever listening to this tape, we're open to this. Okay? And then I could show you passages. And then I could show you passages where the husband is taking initiative. And as I would understand, headship is taught in Scripture. I think that is primarily our responsibility to take initiative. But in every passage, regardless of who takes initiative, the spouse is responsive. The spouse is responsive. And in effect, fulfilling what was written in Proverbs by this author. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. Let her breasts fill you at all time with delight and be intoxicated always with her love. This is no mere duty. This is no mere obligation. This is joy. This is pure joy. It is to be characterized by rejoicing. If your relationship, if your sexual relationship isn't characterized by rejoicing, find out why. Because there's hope in this book and hope in the gospel for you and your marriage, regardless of what seems to separate you at this time. Now listen, that the specifics of heart issues that need to be addressed in your life or the life of your wife normally can't be addressed in the context of preaching. Not minimizing the effect of preaching, but we need to be in local churches where we can receive biblical counseling as well, where somebody can really be a physician for our soul with our supposedly unique set of sin patterns and history. So take advantage of the pastoral counsel. Let this be a provocation if necessary, and receive hope that God intends for this song to be the song that you and your wife sing together, alone. Well, not alone. Before God, for his pleasure ultimately and glory. Now, closing application. Effective lovemaking isn't instinctive. Ed Wheat has written, if you do what comes naturally in lovemaking, almost every time you will be wrong. Listen, are you a skillful lover? Are you an unselfish, skillful lover? Don't assume you are. Ask her. Listen, great sex is the fruit of good communication. Your wife is aroused differently than you are. Humble yourself. Spend time, sometime in the next week or two, saying to her, evaluate my lovemaking. What do I do that arouses you? And what do I do that doesn't? What can I do to arouse you? What can I cease doing that hinders your arousal? Ask her for her evaluation and benefit from her evaluation. You can be a better lover. You can be a better lover. I haven't arrived. You haven't arrived. You might have plateaued, but you haven't arrived. Now, I'd probably be remiss if I didn't say, the more smaller children you have, the more you need to help your wife with those children and create ways for those children to be cared for so that you can have extended, unhurried time together. The smaller the children, the more planning is necessary and the more you need to serve your wife. Also, have realistic expectations. Realistic expectations. Every time you make love, it doesn't mean it's going to be sweating and shouting sex. Douglas Wilson has written, some meals are steaks, some macaroni and cheese. Both are enjoyable. Very relevant to sex. Enjoy the humorous moments. You'll have them. Carol and I have been engaged in lovemaking. We are approaching the height of ecstasy. I get a cramp. Cramps don't negotiate, okay? I can't appeal to a cramp. I try. Just a minute. That's not cramps. Say no. Now. Everything's stopping right now. Pain's increasing. You're done here. I'm a cramp, okay? That's... Well, if you're prepared for that, rather than a lost moment, it becomes a wonderfully humorous memory. How many times also have we had, we're in the midst of lovemaking, and you hear the door, you know? So there's two things. One, there's the fear, because the door handle moves, and then there's the immediate relief, the lock is secured. Then there's the, Dad? Dad? Now, this is a real challenge, because I've got to try to adopt a reading voice. And I'm not reading. Oh, how many times... Yes. Now, my children, if they knew growing up how vulnerable I was, would have used that moment. Can I have a new car? Sure. You can have whatever you want. You just go away right now. I'm good for it. Leave. And then finally, do think about creativity. If you're lovemaking in the same place, at the same time, in the same position, consider a different time and a different place and a different position. The creativity in lovemaking that's evident throughout this song is wonderfully provoking. What a gift. Romance and sex in the context of marriage. How kind of the Lord to give us these gifts. Gentlemen, let us not neglect these gifts. Let us not think of these gifts as of secondary importance. They are of primary importance for the good of your marriage, as an example to your children, for the strengthening of the local church. I would argue for evangelism. I think the church has a voice that needs to be heard on the topic of sex. Culture's not even paying attention to us. May that change. May this culture know the church, not simply as those who preach prohibitions. And I make no apologies for the prohibitions in Scripture. But the prohibitions in Scripture are an expression of a wise and caring and kind God who is protecting us from sin, but he is also preserving us for great God-glorifying sex. And that message needs to be proclaimed in a culture that doesn't know there's an alternative to lust and immorality. So for the good of your marriage, example to your children, local church, evangelism, ultimately for the glory of God, may this song become your song. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.